Hello, this is Kenny Williamson, and welcome back to another episode of McKill's Deck Chronicles. We have had a lot going on around here lately, if you didn't know. One of the things we're doing is putting out a new website. I know that the website that we have now is very dated looking, and it's not a very professional website, but we are putting a lot better one up here real soon. So you will be able to access that at kennywilliamson.com, but we're also going to have truthseekerministries.org, so you'll be able to check that out. Also, we have come up with another book, or I have. I have written a second book. It's called Demons Among Us, and it will be available here really, really soon on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And it is going to kind of complement the existing book that I have out, which is called The Haunting of Virginia Krim. And both of these books are actually true stories about demonic possession and demonic, I guess you would say, activities where these demons have basically showed up. They have imitated people. They have imitated animals and other things. And just a whole lot of crazy stuff that you really wouldn't think about that's going on around us. So, called the second book, Demons Among Us. Pretty interesting, about roughly 200 pages. And, you know, it's about, I don't know, it's like a $10 book, brand new on Amazon. So, if you're interested in that, please go check that out. And on top of that, we are getting ready to transition into a new studio just for this podcast. So it is basically a converted shipping container, and the shipping container has been insulated and interior put in it. And so basically we're going to do this podcast out of a 40-foot shipping container if all works out. And it's going to have a lot of neat stuff in there for sound. So anyway, I'm glad you guys have been sticking with us up to this point. So we got a lot of stuff going on. I've got some interviews coming up. But today is just another one of our Kent Hovind things. We're going to do part two of Kent Hovind's question and answer series, which I think is a very interesting thing to listen to. So I'll go ahead and get that started. And again, if you have any questions, comments, anything, you can go to the website. You can go to our email at truthseekers2012@gmail.com. And when I get this website up and running, we're going to have a new email that's linked to that. So it's going to have a lot better stuff. And on this website, we're going to have some stuff like, I've got some original copies of 1611 King James Bibles, you know, that I would like to get rid of. And brand new, and is still in the wrapper. So I'm going to post a few things on there for sale just to try to, you know, we keep everything free. We keep all our podcasts free, the internet, the website's free, everything's completely free. And so I'm going to list some of these things for sale in case somebody wants them, just to kind of bring some money in to help pay for, you know, the hosting fees and the podcast fees. And there's a 100 million different things to have to pay for. So anyway, I hope you enjoy what you're fixing to listen to, and let me know if I can help you in any way. So here we go.
But there was earth and there was heaven, singular. King James is the only Bible I'm aware of that gets it right in Genesis 1:1, where it says, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth." All the rest of them say heavens. Okay, that's a mistake. There was heaven, which means expanded place. There was earth, and then from here, on out. Then he divides it up into three slices. First heaven, second heaven, third heaven. The first heaven is where the birds fly. Genesis 1 talks about that, verse 20 and 21. Then there was water above the firmament. Now, some creationists do not believe in the canopy theory. I understand. I've read their stuff. I think they're wrong. I still believe, and some accuse me, well, you know, you don't agree with us, therefore, you know, you're not a good creation scientist. You know, to keep up on your research. I keep very much up on the research, and I disagree. It's not that I haven't read it, it's that I have read it and disagree. Okay? But I believe there was a layer of air for Adam to breathe, layer of water above, to protect them, and then a layer of stars, and then more water. The only verse I have to back it up is right here, Psalm 148. Praise Him, ye waters that be above the heavens. That's present tense. Is there still water above the heavens? Psalm 104 says, Who layeth the beams of His chambers in the waters, who maketh the clouds His chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind. Could it be that there is another layer of water beyond all of outer space? Maybe everything that we see as this universe, which looks like huge, maybe everything we see is inside water, a crystal, and God is outside of that, the third heaven, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Could there be a third layer where God lives? Of course, God doesn't need a place to live. He just is, you know. Psalm 29 says, the voice of the Lord is upon the waters. The Lord is upon many waters. Maybe everything that we see when we step out at night and say, wow, look at all these stars. Maybe the whole thing's a little snow globe on God's dresser, you know, that He picks up and shakes once in a while. How you doing in there? You know, I don't know. I like to think that way. But the Psalm 148, the waters that be above the heavens, you know, people have often asked, hey, where's the last star? And once we find it, what's on the other side? I don't know the answers to those, but just a possibility is that there, according to the Bible, may still be water above the heavens. But there's a lot of stars out there. Hubble estimate was 11 trillion stars per person. That is 76 trillion divided by 6 billion people. Every one of you gets 11 trillion stars. What happened, they told the Hubble telescope to focus in on a dot. They found a dot above the Big Dipper. You can see the picture of it there. It is about the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length. And it was black. They said, we don't think there's any stars there. Let's focus in on that spot and see what we can find. They took pictures for 10 days straight, focusing in on that dot. After 10 days, there were more stars in that dot than they could count. These were brand new stars, never been seen before. Called it deep field, Hubble deep field. Looking up there saying, man, that's stuff we didn't know about. Assumption would be that it's that way all through space. Truly, the stars cannot be numbered, which is what the Bible says. They cannot be numbered. But how do you tell the distance to the stars, and how can the Earth be 6,000 years old and the stars be so far away? Fair question. Stephen Hawking said, stars are so far away, they appear to be just pinpoints of light. We cannot see their size or shape. How do we tell different types of stars apart? For the vast majority, there's only one thing we can see, and that is the color of their light. If you get the biggest telescope on Earth, this is not it, by the way, spotting scope, but if you get the largest telescope on Earth and look at the closest star, which is Alpha Centauri, 4.5 light years away, all you're going to see is a dot. If I focus this in on the Sun, it'll start to get, you know, bigger and bigger, and you can actually see flames leaping off and see the spicules, and you can see color changes, and you can actually see features of the Sun. When you look at a star, you never get to see that. Nobody has ever seen a star as far as any of the features of it. You get the biggest telescope on Earth, it's going to be nothing but a dot in your scope. All you can tell is, I say, that's a red one, that's a yellow one, that's a blue one. That's all you can see. So anything we do, we have to do based on assumptions just from the color. But how do you tell the distance to the star? Well, I taught high school trig for years, and if you guys had trig, you know how it works. If you have two observation points, you can calculate the third distance. You have to know it's solving a triangle. Trigonometry deals with triangles, so you sine, cosine, tangent. If you know one distance and two angles, or two distances and one angle, you can calculate the rest of the triangle using sine, cosine, tangent. Here's the problem. Earth is only 8,000 miles in diameter, which compared to star distance is zero. It's nothing. So if I'm looking at a star and somebody over in China is looking at a star, we are 8,000 miles away from each other, straight line through the Earth. That would be nothing. What they've done to enlarge the distance to look at a star, instead of just being opposite sides of the Earth is also going around the Sun in this great big huge circle. We're going 66,000 miles an hour, and it takes us a year to go around. Great big racetrack. Well, the distance from the Earth to the Sun is about 93 million miles, average. And that's a lot, but at the speed of light, it's not much. At the speed of light, it's 8 minutes away. It takes the sunlight 8 minutes to get to the Earth. So if we're eight light minutes from the Sun, the diameter of our orbit going around is 16 light minutes. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at a star in January, and then we're going to look at the star in June, and we have now gone halfway around this monster circle. And we're going to get two observation points to try to enlarge the base of our triangle. And it sounds huge. Man, that's 186 million miles. Well, it's still not much. A year has 525,000 minutes in a year. If this picture here showing the little yellow dot was the scale, if that yellow dot represented Earth's orbit, not the Earth's diameter, the orbit of the Earth, it's way too big for the picture. What we're going to do is try to get to show you the math involved here. If I had two surveyors setting up with their transits or telescopes, and they are 16 inches away from each other, and they're both looking at a dot 525,000 inches away, which is 8 1/3 miles, would you agree that would make a rather skinny triangle? Let's go out in the parking lot and draw a triangle with point A and point B 16 inches apart, and point C 8 1/3 miles away. It's going to make a real skinny triangle. That is exactly the triangle you get when two people on opposite sides of Earth's orbit try to measure one light year. One. Now, and I'm not sure you can tell exactly where you were 6 months ago. I think that would be a little stretch of the imagination to say, oh yeah, 6 months ago in January we were, where were we? I'll give them that. I won't even argue that. I just would bring that up, you know, for appeal, Your Honor, in case we need to. You can't know exactly where you were 6 months ago. But the angle you get with that is 0.017 degrees. Now let's imagine this. I want you to get two guys to set up their surveying transits. They're 16 inches apart, and I'm going to go put a dot 8 1/3 miles away, but they don't know how far away it is. They're both focusing in on the dot, and they see this dot out there. Here's the only information they have: the measurement between themselves, 16 inches, and the angle out of parallel. I say, guys, I want you to calculate how far away that dot is based on that little angle change you get. I think that would be difficult to measure, one light year. There'd be some guesswork involved, okay? Now, if you want to measure 100 light years, you got a much worse problem. Now you got to move your dot 830 miles away. If we had two guys on the roof of this building here in Pensacola, Florida, 16 inches apart, and they're both focusing on a dot in Chicago, which is 830 miles away, but they don't know how far away it is, they're going to tell me how far away it is, based only on their angle of their telescope out of parallel. I would say that's impossible. Impossible. To measure 15 billion, no question, that's impossible. I don't think you can measure 100 light years. Not with real numbers, not with real measurements, but this textbook says they can measure, parallax trigonometry can measure up to 100 light years. Okay, I doubt it, but I'll give them 100. I'll give them 1,000 if they quit crying, okay? The fact is you can't measure a billion. Simple fact. So here's some things to consider about starlight. It said in 2004 that the new SIM technology, Space Interferometry Mission, they hope to get where they can improve the distance of measuring stars. And they say this accuracy will enable SIM to determine stellar distances to 10% accuracy out to a distance of 482,000 million million miles. That's 82,000 light years. And then it says, this is an improvement of several hundred times over what is possible today. Well, now, wait a minute. If they're going to improve it several hundred times, and it ends up being 82,000, was 82,000 divided by several hundred comes out to be several hundred. Apparently, they're admitting they can only measure several hundred light years, which I would agree. I mean, I would say that's even a stretch, but I'll give them several hundred. They can't measure billions, is the point. So when you students in school get taught, oh, that star is, 14.629 billion light years away, I don't believe you. I don't believe you at all. It might be, but you can't prove that. They're making up a story. With SIM technology, they hope to finally be able to get out to where they can measure most of the way across our galaxy, and we're in it. We can't even measure across our own galaxy, let alone these distances to other galaxies. So I think we should look at the stars and say, wow, what a mighty God we serve. instead of going out there and say, well, we know how far that way it is. We know it evolved. I mean, it's just that egotistical attitude some of these atheists get that makes you want to slap them in the face. Like, man, why don't you serve God? Look what he made, you know? Here's the things to consider concerning starlight. Then we'll take a break. Number one, we cannot measure these great distances. It just cannot be done. Number two, nobody knows what light is. Is it, they call it a wave or a photon or a particle. You know, we know what it does. We use it all the time. But actually, give me a jar of it and paint it red. Nobody knows the substance of it. What is light? And we sure don't know that it always travels the same speed all through time or space. The entire theory behind a black hole is that light can be attracted by gravity. Well, if light can be attracted by gravity, then you cannot say the speed of light is a constant. Okay? At Harvard University back in 99, they slowed light down to 38 miles an hour. The next year, they slowed it down to 1 mile an hour. And the next year brought it to a dead stop. Light goes, you know, pretty quick, 186,000 miles a second. They slowed it down. It was done at Harvard. It was done at Smithsonian. It was done at Cambridge University. A repeatable, demonstrable experiment. Now that is science. If you do an experiment, get a result, somebody else follows your data, does the same experiment, gets the same result, that's science. They slowed light down. This article came out on Fox News Channel. They said, we've succeeded in holding a light pulse still. They brought the speed of light to zero, brought it to a dead stop. Meanwhile, back in 2000 at Princeton University, they speeded light up to 300 times the speed of light. So when somebody says that star is 10 billion light years away, which I doubt they can measure, therefore that we can prove the universe is 10 billion years old, they got several problems in their logic right away that they probably don't see, which is why we do these seminars, so we can help people understand. It's 300 times the speed of light. Astronomer Barry Setterfield, an Australian government astronomer, said, during the last 300 years, 164 measurements of the speed of light have been published using 16 different measurement techniques. The speed of light has apparently decreased so rapidly, experimental error cannot explain it. This is a chart showing the decline in the speed of light from the published numbers in the last 150 years. You notice the decline in the chart. The speed of light's getting slower until about 1960. For the last 40 years, anybody that's measured the speed of light gets the same number, 186,282.4, I think, miles per second. Who cares? Well, it could be that it leveled off in 1960 for two possible reasons, three possible reasons. Our way of measuring is getting better. Instruments are getting better. We're smarter. You know, everybody in the past was dumb. We're smart. We got it right. Could be. That's what they'll tell you. Second option, though, is we're at the tail end of a logarithmic curve, and you're much less likely to see any decline. As you get further out on the logarithmic curve, it pretty much levels out. But a third reason is, 1956 is when they invented the atomic clock. And they started using that as their clock to measure the speed of light. Well, now, wait. The atomic clock is based on the wavelength of a cesium-133 atom. So the clock is based on the speed of light. Now, if you have a clock based on the speed of light and you're measuring the speed of light with it, if the speed of light changes, you're never going to catch it with that clock. It's like watching two twins grow next to each other. Well, neither one's growing. Well, duh. You got a rubber ruler problem here. Clear back in 87, they said, the speed of light was 10 billion times faster at time zero. There must have been a faster speed of light. There have been articles from the 80s, 90s, 2000s saying, look, the speed of light is not a constant. They said, no physical law prevents anything from exceeding the speed of light. In two published experiments, the speed of light was apparently exceeded by as much as a factor of 100. The Big Bang Theory requires a much faster speed of light. Dr. Magluocci, however you pronounce his name here, I got his book on the table. He says, a shocking possibility is the speed of light might change in time during the life of the universe. Could it be the speed of light was faster? Here's an article in the newspaper said, speed of light may have changed over history, study says. Winnipeg Free Press, nothing's reliable, not even the speed of light. We have shown that a time-varying speed of light could provide a resolution to well-known cosmological puzzles. One of the mysteries of a decaying speed of light seems to be able to explain why opposite extremes of the cosmos that are too far apart to have been in contact with each other appear to obey the same rules of physics, and even about the same temperatures. It would only be possible for light to cross from one side to the other if it traveled much faster than today, moments after the universe was created. Is the speed of light really a constant? There are articles here in Reuters News Service, the speed of light may not be a constant. I have dozens of articles like this in the last 15 years, and this will be much more detail in our college class about the speed of light. So don't let somebody tell you the speed of light is a constant. We don't know that. Big article came out in Discover Magazine, says, was Einstein wrong about the speed of light back in 2000? He said, yeah, Einstein was wrong. The speed of light is not a constant. There's the book by the Italian scientist, I'm assuming he's Italian. He says, look, the speed of light is not a constant. And there have been many articles published about this. You can read them for yourself. I'll flash through them quickly here and you can get the details. So the third thing to consider, the creation was finished when God made it. Not only can we not measure those distances, not only is the speed of light not necessarily a constant, the creation was done. See, Jesus made wine out of grapes that never existed. He missed all that time. Instead of going from the water in the ground, through the plant, into the grape, squeeze it, make the wine, now drink it. No, Jesus turned the water straight to wine. What happened to all the intermediate steps? God can bypass all that. He doesn't need any of that. Okay? I ask people the question, how old was Adam on day 6? Anybody know? How old was Adam on day 6? 0. Did he look 0? No. He looked 52, 53 next month. But he looked perfect, top, you know, physical condition. God didn't make two babies and put them in the Garden of Eden and hand them a package of seeds and say, here, plant these quick. You're going to need supper. It has to be a full-grown man, full-grown woman, full-grown garden. They got to have supper like tonight, you know. Better be something hanging on the tree ready to eat. Even if you plant a tree, you're going to take 4 or 5 years to get fruit off it. So the creation had to be mature. A fourth thing to consider about the speed of light question. A light year is a distance. It's not a time. It's a distance. And since the speed of light is not proven to be consistent, why would star distance have anything to do with the age of the universe? Now, I am not saying and have never said all of the stars are inside of a 6,000-mile radius of the Earth. That is not what I say. I don't know any creationist that teaches that. So when they say that, they're setting up a straw man, you know, knocking it down. They're lying, basically. The stars probably are billions of light years away. They probably are. We just can't measure them, that's all. I like this article in the Discover. It said, how do scientists measure the age of stars? They said, well, we can find the absolute ages by comparing a star's color and brightness with those in stellar evolution models. What? We can tell how old it is by how old we think it is. That's exactly what they're saying right there. That's dumb, okay? Now, I think everybody's asking the totally wrong question. Everybody's saying, how did the light get from the star to the earth? They're asking the wrong question. 17 times in the Bible, it says God stretched out the heavens. Well, if He stretched out the heavens, they're asking the wrong question. It's not how did the light get from the star to here, but how did the star get from here to there? That's the question we need to be asking. The Bible says pretty clearly God made the earth first, and then He made the stars also. And He stretched, suppose He made the earth, and then He stretched out the stars from here. Adam would see the stars on day 6, and day 7, and day 8. As the star is being stretched out into place, it's going to leave behind a trail of light. So the stars could be billions of light years away today, and still have been created in the 6 days, 6,000 years ago. Russell Humphreys has a book, which I read, and I just have to say, I didn't understand it, all of it. He's really, really smart, but it's a good one on starlight and time, if you want to get more on that. I don't know that I agree with his premise. I think he starts with the assumption the speed of light is a constant. Now, how do we explain that? And they get into this warped space and bent space stuff. I think it's much simpler. The speed of light's not a constant, and God made things and stretched them out into place. So, if that stretching took place, maybe that explains why we have a red shift. And we'll cover the red shift question in just a minute after the break. Okay, let's go on to the question we often get. Well, what about the red shift? Doesn't that prove the universe is expanding? Or doesn't that prove the universe is billions of years old? Let me explain what they're talking about. If light shines through a prism, it breaks it up into the rainbow colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Okay? Well, if you take starlight and shine it through a prism by putting a prism on the back of your telescope, you look at the star, the light comes through and it gets broken up into the same red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. And you can kind of tell what's burning because different things burn different colors, like copper burns green. And each element produces a distinctive color. And so they can kind of tell what's in the star and how it's burning by what color of light it produces. So you can learn a lot about the star from the light. However, As they look at the spectroscope, the colors it produces, there's little black lines in starlight indicating something's burning, a particular element's burning, but they're shifted toward the red. If you notice the center picture up there, its black lines are shifted over toward the red side, and that's called the red shift. So the question is, what would be causing this? Why would some of these stars have the black lines shifted over toward the red? Well, there are several theories about what's causing it. The most commonly accepted theory, and probably the only one that students are ever taught in school, is that the redshift is caused by what's called the Doppler effect. If you've been waiting at the train tracks when a train is coming, as the train's coming toward you, it is squeezing the sound waves, and so the pitch goes up. And when the train leaves you, it is stretching the sound waves, and so the pitch drops, and it goes as it goes by. That's called the Doppler effect. Who cares? Well, this happens, okay? Whether the sound is moving past you or you moving past the sound, it doesn't matter. You still get this Doppler effect, the change in pitch. Well, the theory is that if a star was moving toward us, it would squeeze the light waves, giving it a blue shift. And if it is leaving us, it would give us a red shift because it would stretch the light out. That's the theory, okay? What really causes it? I don't think anybody knows for sure. This guy said there was an early sign that redshifts reliably indicate the distance to quasars. For quasars, however, the diagram shows a wide scatter in apparent brightness at every redshift. In fact, there is little correlation of brightness to redshift at all. Either quasars come in an extremely wide range of intrinsic luminosities, or, as most people believe, or their redshifts do not indicate distance. I don't think anybody knows for sure what's causing the redshift, but you certainly can't tell the distance to a star based on the redshift, and that's exactly what they try to do. They look at stars and say, oh, that one's redshifted more. That must be, 10.5 billion light years away instead of 10.2 or something. They make up an awful lot of imagination stuff over just a real little bit of science, in my opinion. This fellow said in Sky and Telescope magazine, thus, for us, the only conclusion that can be drawn is that at least some quasars are relatively nearby, and a large fraction of their redshift is due to something other than expansion of the universe. Basically, he's saying, we're not sure exactly what's causing the redshift. It might be that they're nearby. There's a good book you can get. I highly recommend this one called The Evolution Cruncher. It's a 900-page book, and it's like $5. He's got a whole section in here on page 52 about the evolution, about the redshift and the Doppler effect and what causes it. Got some really good stuff. And these you can give out to every high school kid you know. But there's a good section in there about the redshift, what's causing it. This article says, quasars with an enormous redshift was found embedded in a nearby spiral galaxy with a far, far lower redshift. Now, how can one star be inside of another star and they're giving you two different redshifts if this indicates distance? If they're the same, if a quasar is inside a galaxy, they should both give you the same redshift, both at the same distance away. But they admitted they found this quasar inside of a galaxy that had different redshifts, but yet they're obviously the same distance away. So they said, according to the standard Big Bang view of the universe, the objects we call quasars are generally supposed to be at the very edge of the visible universe. They're supposed to be superluminous black holes with 1 million or 100 million times more mass than our sun, surrounded by a disk of matter, our material. Some of the material falls into the black hole, causing the emission of huge amounts of energy. There's a big article when they discovered this, Discovery poses cosmic puzzle. Can a distant quasar live within a nearby galaxy? This really created a problem. How on earth can we have these two objects that are different distances at the same location? Well, it's not a problem if you realize that you can't trust the redshift to measure the distance. But they're so anxious to say the universe is billions of light years across, and it probably is, and then use that as evidence to say, therefore, it's billions of years old. And that's why this all becomes a problem for them. If they would just accept the Bible, it wouldn't be a problem at all. This article said, quasar with enormous redshift found embedded in nearby spiral galaxy with far lower redshift. Unsolvable riddle for Big Bang astronomy. I agree. If you believe the Big Bang theory, that is an unsolvable problem. Science News ran an article said, another set of observations indicates that the universe appears to be 8.4 to 10.6 billion years old. The new work relied on Hubble Space Telescope to obtain distance to faraway galaxies. The team led by Tanvir of the University of Cambridge in England used a two-step method to estimate the Hubble constant. Now stop and think about that. How many of you have had algebra before? You had algebra? You have variables in your equation, okay? Well, if a variable times a constant, if one constant changes, that's going to change your whole answer. So most of this distance stuff they're doing with stars is based on what they call the Hubble constant. But they don't even know what that is. The Hubble constant is estimated. Well, that's going to radically affect your outcome of your equation. So is the universe 8.4 billion years old, or is it 10.6, or is it, when I debated Hugh Ross at Reasons to Believe, he said it's 17.42 billion years old. 17.42, how do you know that? Some textbooks say 18, some say 20, some say 12. The numbers range all over the scale. The fact is, they don't know. They're making up numbers, purely making them up. The article goes on to say, you have to be very careful about drawing conclusions because of the Hubble constant. Measurements have huge systematic errors. I like this article. It came out in Discover magazine a couple years ago. Astronomers believed the Veil, one of the best studied supernova remnants, was 2,500 light years away and 18,000 years old. They were quite wrong. In fact, the Veil is only 1,500 light years away and 5,000 years old. So here just 4 years ago, they're discovering they got radically wrong numbers. How do you know any of the numbers they're telling us are right? I think we should say, look, until somebody's proven the Bible wrong, I'm going to believe it. Instead of saying, well, the scientists are saying it's wrong, so therefore we must believe the scientists. Don't go along with that. Even the nearest Cepheids, a Cepheid variable, are so remote, it's difficult to determine their absolute distance with any great accuracy. All large distances in astronomical literature are subject to an error of perhaps 10% from this cause alone. There are lots of different things that can cause errors in these measurements. We talked about the measuring, the triangulation, measuring with trigonometry. You got incredible errors built into that. The numbers are just so big. The distances are so large, you can't do it. They say, we know that faintness, that's how bright the star is, arises from two causes, distance and absorbing matter in space. This is what's happening. They look at a star and say, wow, we know that one is, 4 billion light years away. And look at that one over there. That one's only half as bright. So it must be, 8 billion light years away. They use the inverse square law. And that's all logical if there's nothing in between absorbing the light or scattering the light. Just because a star is dimmer doesn't necessarily mean it's farther. It might be something's in between, a dust cloud. Outer space, space is full of all kinds of stuff. Anyway, the guy admits, it's not generally possible to apportion it between the two. There's more about Halton Harp and what happened to him, the persecution that happened to him, because he dared to question the redshift. All he did was expose the problems with it. He said, guys, that redshift has problems. Oh, well, then you're fired and you get out of here and don't you ever come back, until you repent. Because you just don't question some things, they're sacred.
And there you have it. That was another episode of Dr. Kent Hovind and his question and answer series. That was part number two. We are going to have the other parts out. It's basically, I'm just trying to condense this down to about 30-some minutes, so it's easier to listen to. It's actually about a 2.5-hour long presentation, but nobody has time to listen to 2.5 hours, and it takes up a lot of memory and everything to post all that. So I'm trying to do this in 30-minute increments, roughly. So I hope you like it. Like I said in the beginning, if you didn't catch it, you can email us at truthseekers2012@gmail.com. You can go to our website and check that out, which it's fixing to be revamped. So it's going to look a whole lot better. It's going to have a lot better information on it, laid out a little easier to get to. And so if you feel like, feel led to donate anything, there's a Tithely link on there. If you have anything you want to donate, you can mail it to us if you want to, like Bibles or books or anything that we could give out, or tracts or anything like that. We'd be happy to do it. So thanks for listening. God bless you.